Spring bird migrations are picking up as shadows shorten on the winter landscape. So it's no surprise that recently, in Silver Spring, Maryland, I stumbled on a group of birders with binoculars and notebooks. They were looking for a white-winged crossbill. It's a little finch that normally prefers to brave out the cold in the forests of Canada, maybe venturing down as far as New York State. It's a rare sighting for Maryland residents, which explains why reports of a sighting of the white-winged crossbill brought Dan Rubin and John Haslinger out one afternoon. The two are self-described bird dweebs.
Dan and I saw a golden eagle last week on the eastern shore, and we saw a dovekie. That is an Arctic bird that was rare down here. But that's what I'm talking about when I say dweeb. You're willing to get in your car and go a distance to see a bird that you've never seen before.
Call it what you like, dweebiness, passion. It's a human instinct to watch birds. At least, that's the premise of Jonathan Rosen's new book, The Life of the Skies, Birding at the End of Nature. Rosen is a novelist and essayist and a Manhattanite who began his life as a bird watcher in Central Park.
The single most powerful thing about birding for me is the fact that, on the one hand, you do it with a book. You have a guidebook in your pocket. You go out into the woods with your book, and you are constantly trying to name the birds. You're gathering them into the library world, into this system of nomenclature that dates to the 18th century. At the same time that you're doing this intensely civilizing activity with a book in your hand, the birds are luring you out into the wild world, deeper into the natural world. And it is the tension between those things that I find so stirring.
I was struck how many people, how many poets had written about birds, how often birds come into mythology and history, and we're going to discuss the lives of some of the great ornithologists in this book. But you also talk about the biologist Edward O. Wilson, and he said human beings need nature in order to be happy.
That's right. And actually, one of the little by little ways that I got into birding was I had read Edward O. Wilson's biography, autobiography called Naturalist. And I was so stirred by it and so moved by it. He'd had a very poor childhood from a broken home, and he simply wandered around Alabama gathering up snakes and looking at the wild world. And it became his consolation and his comfort, and it led him through life. And he has later devised this notion, which he calls biophilia, that it is actually part of our genetic makeup, that we need to be with nature. Now, that doesn't mean we only need to conserve nature. It may be the killing urge as well as the conserving urge. But simply to feel whole and happy, we need to be connected to the wild world, which is where, after all, we evolved as a species.
And you say that birds shuttle between what is urban in us and what is wild.
That's right. I mean, I often say, when I'm asked, why do you go watch birds in Central Park? And the answer is quite simply and sadly, the birds are all that's left of the wild world. You know, if buffalo or caribou passed through Central Park, I'd go out and see them for sure. But birds are really the only wild animals left that still migrate along these ancient migratory pathways.
And you talk about the father of American birding as being Alexander Wilson, and you had a very interesting story about him and a bird that everyone has come to be obsessed with, and that's the ivory-billed woodpecker, which was a lot more common, since we don't even know if it exists, at the time that Wilson encountered it.
Yeah, Wilson was a great ornithologist, born in Scotland, active at the very beginning of the 19th century. And he tells a story about capturing an ivory bill, which he wounds in the wing, in order to paint it, and he brings it to a hotel room. And he hides it under his cloak when he comes to the hotel room, and he asks for a room. He says, "For myself and my baby, the bird is crying like an infant." And he brings it into the room, and he ties it. Well, first he lets it fly free and leaves for a little while. And when he comes back, the bird has basically chiseled a hole in the wall and is very near escaping. So he ties it to a mahogany table. He has to go out again, and this time when he comes back, the table is completely ruined. He's filled with admiration for the bird, which actually dies a couple of days later, not because it was so badly wounded, but because it seemed to Wilson that it just had this kind of proud, defiant spirit and would not be tamed. But what I find so moving and telling about that story is here is a bird who Wilson shot. Effectively, he killed it. And in those days, everyone who was a bird watcher was a bird killer. You killed them to look at them. At the same time, he pretends the bird is his child. And although it's a joke, it's a very telling joke, because we have this intimate relationship to the natural world that we are simultaneously striving against and also simultaneously propping up. One of the reasons hunters make such good conservationists is because they acknowledge that aspect of themselves. People who go duck hunting have been very early and active in preserving the places where ducks live because they want to keep shooting them.
You've woven a lot of poetry into this book and a little bit of philosophy. Could you tell us more about the title of this book, The Life of the Skies, and where that came from?
Sure. The Life of the Skies comes from a D.H. Lawrence prose poem. It's part of a wonderful collection of poems called Birds, Beasts, and Flowers. And the poem begins, "Birds are the life of the skies, and when they fly, they reveal the thoughts of the skies." And I had been very taken with that line for a very long time, long before I knew how I was going to write this book. But I misremembered the line. I thought it was when they sing, they reveal the thoughts of the skies, not when they fly. And I was happy when I discovered I was wrong, because it's not anything that they say. It's not they can't articulate meaning. It's the sheer fact that they exist at all that is so mysterious. And I think I also liked it that the title, The Life of the Skies, really has a kind of theological overtone. Because I do believe that looking for birds, looking for anything in the natural world, has not only those hunting urges which drives us out into the wild world, but a desire to find meaning in nature and even perhaps meaning behind nature. What is the life of the skies? After Darwin, do we believe that the skies are empty of, you know, angels, thrones, powers, divine force, and that it's simply the animal world that fills it? Or is it, in fact, even though it may only be the animal world that fills it, does that animal world itself contain a suggestion of divinity?
But you also say that if you're going to talk about the life of the skies and castles in the air, so to speak, that you need to preserve the foundation beneath the skies, and that even as you're discovering birds and thinking about nature sanctuaries, human beings often devour the habitat.
That's right. The birds I see passing through in springtime, they spend the winter in Central America or South America, and they're on their way north to Canada, perhaps. And so one of the great things about birding is that your mind expands outwardly into this wide web, whether you travel or not, but it also forces you to realize there is no such thing as a single forest. I may see birds in the equivalent of my backyard, but actually, if I don't think about how to preserve the forests where they spend the winter or the places where they go to breed, then those birds won't be there.
Jonathan Rosen. His new book is called The Life of the Skies, Birding at the End of Nature. Jonathan Rosen, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Rosen includes many poems in his book, The Life of the Skies. Here's The Ovenbird by Robert Frost. There's a singer everyone has heard, loud, a midsummer and a midwood bird, who makes the solid tree trunk sound again. He says that leaves are old, and that for flowers, midsummer is to spring as 1 to 10. He says the early petal fall is past when pear and cherry bloom went down in showers, on sunny days a moment overcast. And comes that other fall we name the fall, he says the highway dust is over all. The bird would cease and be as other birds, but that he knows in singing not to sing. The question that he frames in all but words is what to make of a diminished thing. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. Sergio Vieira de Mello, the United Nations envoy in Iraq, was killed there when terrorists blew up the Canal Hotel in Baghdad in August of 2003. De Mello was 55 when he died. He'd had a career as a high-level diplomat who'd started working for the UN when he was just 21. A Brazilian, de Mello was charming and persuasive, multilingual, a hard-working cosmopolitan, and a veteran of many war zones from Rwanda to East Timor. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power has published a new biography of de Mello, showing how his own life and career in many ways reflected the changing mission of the United Nations. Her book is called Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, and Samantha Power joins us now. Welcome to the program, Samantha.
Great to be here, Jackie.
Would you remind people, please, our listeners, of who Sergio de Mello was and what the path was that he took to become one of the world's most prominent diplomats?
Well, when I first met Sergio in Bosnia in 1994, I was told in advance of my meeting that I was about to meet somebody who was a cross between James Bond on the one hand and Bobby Kennedy on the other. And I thought, wow, who is this masked man? And what he had done is he had joined the UN after being a student radical or student revolutionary in his own mind. In Paris in 1968, had thrown stones at police and stormed the barricades and protested the state and imperialism and all bad things. He wore his leftism very, very loudly, he used to say, in those days. And he saw the United Nations in some ways as an alternative to imperialism, as an alternative to the state. Of course, as soon as he joined the UN at age 21, he quickly realized that the UN was both the place where we parked our principles, but also a gathering of states. And that tension between the UN as the sum of the better angels of the world, but also the UN as just a gathering of self-interested state actors was a tension and a line he walked for most of his career.
Why was he deployed so ubiquitously?
Well, he was a person who spoke seven languages. As he accreted these experiences in prior war zones, of course, he became a person that could reliably handle the stress of having bullets and shells land around you. He liked to negotiate with evil. He liked to engage with anyone from the Bosnian Serbs to the genocidaire in Congo to Muqtada al-Sadr in the summer of 2003 in Iraq. By the end of his career, I should say that he began to look back on that side of himself and be very troubled by it. I think Srebrenica, the massacre there in 1995, and the genocide in Rwanda were turning points for him. So by the end, he retained that belief that you had to be in the room with the people who posed the greatest threats. But while in the room, he was quite adamant about actually raising the harms and the crimes and not pretending as though history hadn't happened.
So by the time the invasion of Iraq was looming in 2003, it was rumored that he was going to be Kofi Annan's special representative there. He had just come from East Timor, where he'd had quite a successful couple of years. But he himself was ambivalent about the job, and it was true that many UN staff were very opposed to UN involvement in Baghdad. So why did he go?
Well, the short answer is he went to Iraq because he was asked. He asked Kofi not to ask him. But in the end, both Annan, both Secretary General and Sergio put the UN's welfare above their own kind of personal considerations. And Sergio felt, if the Secretary General of this organization that I have given my life to believes that I can do more good than harm and that the UN will be itself benefited by me going there, I have no choice but to go. But I'm only going to go for 4 months, and then I'm going to resume the life that I'm intent now on having going forward.
So he goes to Baghdad in June of 2003, sets up UN offices at the Canal Hotel, intended to leave at the end of September, but he never made that because, of course, of the attack. Regarding the attack, the UN would later come in for severe criticism about its lack of security arrangements, the road that ran behind the Canal Hotel was open, the windows weren't taped, there weren't enough guards. Why didn't DeMello take greater precautions?
Well, the bureaucratic answer is he was actually not in charge of security. Somebody else was in charge of security, but that's a bad answer. That's a UN answer. The longer answer is Sergio actually very deliberately set up the Canal Hotel headquarters as a kind of anti-green zone, very willfully saying, okay, if Bremer is setting up shop in Saddam Hussein's palaces and there are walls and sandbags and barbed wire and Iraqis are having to wait out in the hot sun for hours on end in order to make complaints, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm actually going to create a space where Iraqis can come in, file their grievances, check their email, and by virtue of doing that, I'm going to get a read on the Iraqi street that's actually going to help us figure out how to do this transition away from an American administration very quickly. But one of the perverse tragedies of all of this is that because President Bush predicated the war on a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and because so many in the international community were skeptical of that claim, people in the UN and in foreign embassies in Iraq were probably too slow to actually recognize that al-Qaeda wasn't there beforehand but had come in the wake of the invasion. And so paradoxically, the anti-Americanism may have done the UN a disservice.
Would you please describe what happened on August the 19th of 2003? Sergio Vieira de Mello is trapped in the rubble after a truck bomb hits the building. He's buried under concrete for 3.5 hours. There appears to be no evacuation plan, no rescue equipment, no nothing, really.
Well, this is the other tragic, perverse aspect of the story of the UN in Iraq and the story of Sergio in Iraq and the story of the loss of 22 people, not just of him. Bush, of course, again, predicated the war on this link between terrorism and Saddam Hussein, and yet didn't actually instruct the U.S. military to do any preparation for large-scale attacks on civilian targets. In other words, if you were going to believe that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein were linked or that al-Qaeda was in Iraq, surely then you would have prepared for the kinds of attacks that al-Qaeda is notorious for. But that's not what was done. And so what happened when the bomb went off in the afternoon of August 19, 2003, is, it has to be said, U.S. soldiers in an ad hoc way did a heroic job running into the rubble, rescuing people who could be rescued. But when it came to actually bringing to bear the tools of the most powerful superpower in the history of mankind, very little sophisticated was done. In the rubble, Sergio lay, having lengthy conversations, asking about the welfare of his staff. Two American soldiers, American firemen, in fact, scaled down into the shaft that Sergio was buried in, under the rubble, and all they had to bring to bear was literally a curtain that had been taken from the Canal Hotel, which was used as a stretcher. They had a lady's handbag, a straw lady's handbag that they used and put rubble inside the handbag and then developed a pulley system with the curtain rope. And that was what was brought to bear. There was no shoring wood, so the walls were trembling. The rocks, every time they would lift rubble from above Sergio, the rocks would come tumbling back down on top of him. It was the most primitive rescue effort you can imagine.
You write so movingly of these last 3.5 hours of his life. You say, as his life seeped slowly out of him, there must have been a moment, hopefully not a long one, when he realized he was every bit as helpless in his time of need as millions of victims had been before him. He died under the Canal Hotel's rubble, buried beneath the weight of the United Nations itself. Samantha Power is the author of Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello, and The Fight to Save the World. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jackie.
Now it's time to brush up on your British monarchs. A film about King Henry VIII and his second wife, Anne Boleyn, opens this week. It's called The Other Boleyn Girl. Yes, there was more than just one. Here's a clip from the movie.
I'm aware of one Boleyn girl, but she's lying in with a certain child in her belly. What do you mean, the other one? The one who almost killed me. Well, come on, other Boleyn girl, show your face.
The other Boleyn girl is Anne's sister, Mary, who was Henry's mistress, before Anne. But there is yet another Boleyn girl, Jane. Jane was married to Anne and Mary's brother, George. She later served as lady-in-waiting to Catherine Howard, Henry's fifth wife. Both women met the same fate as Anne. Jane Boleyn was maligned as a traitor and scorned as a scandalous woman. Historian Julia Fox wants to restore Jane's reputation. She aims to set the record straight in her new book, Jane Boleyn, The True Story of the Infamous Lady Rochford. Julia Fox is in our London bureau. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
How was it that Jane Parker entered into the inner circles of Henry VIII's court?
Entirely through her marriage, and entirely by accident. Tudor women were expected to marry, but to marry into a family that suddenly was catapulted into Henry's inner sanctum was very, very unusual. It wasn't Jane herself that originally got there. It was because she married George, Anne's brother. So it's through her marriage.
Through her marriage. Her
yes.
marriage to George, it was arranged, but in your account it was a pretty happy union, I mean, given the kinds of unions that were made at the time. And Anne Boleyn became Henry's wife and queen under famous circumstances. Henry tried to get his first marriage to Catherine of Aragon annulled. He failed, and that changed the course of both history and religion in the kingdom. Yes. Anne then failed to produce a male heir. Henry fell in love with Jane Seymour, and Anne was beheaded. But George Boleyn was beheaded then as well. Why was George killed?
allegedly because he and Anne had committed incest. And allegedly, later on, of course, the argument is that the evidence for that was actually given by his own wife, My Jane. And this is really what interested me, I think, in Jane, in that I couldn't quite see why any woman would actually do that if it was a lie. And I don't think really, well, I know there is no evidence to suggest that it's actually true.
What kind of relationship did she have with Catherine Howard, Henry's fifth wife?
I think a very good one. She'd known Catherine Howard earlier. In fact, after Anne's death, Jane became lady-in-waiting to Henry's next wife, Jane Seymour. She was actually one of the chief mourners at Jane's funeral. She was fighting her way back, you see. She's quite a modern lady. She was lady-in-waiting to his next wife, Anne of Cleves. And it was while she was lady-in-waiting to Anne of Cleves that she met Catherine Howard, who was also Anne of Cleves' lady-in-waiting. And for some reason, the two women just hit it off. And she became a confidant to Catherine.
What were the charges that were brought against Jane Boleyn and Catherine Howard, charges that resulted in both of them being beheaded on the same day?
Catherine's sexual adventures, to put it bluntly. Catherine actually had had a very highly charged sex life before she met Henry. That was bad enough, but she'd continued to meet one particular young man, Thomas Culpepper, after her marriage to Henry. In order for Catherine Howard to meet Thomas Culpepper, she needed somebody to take messages. She needed somebody to stand guard. And she persuaded Jane to do precisely that.
If I were to conjure an imaginary scenario where you actually had the chance to talk to Jane, what questions would you ask her?
I think I'd probably ask her a little bit more about her relationship with Anne. It would be wonderful to sort of listen in to some of their chat, I think. But I would also want to ask her, definitely, why was it you actually did stand outside Catherine Howard's room? Because I think that is really much more difficult to explain. But I'd love to just say, why?
Julia Fox is the author of Jane Boleyn, published by Ballantine, and she joined us from our London bureau. Thank you.
Thank you.
Haruko plays tennis well. She speaks French beautifully and has a wealthy father. But she is a commoner. One day in the late 1940s, she and her mother stand outside the Imperial Palace in Tokyo and see the Crown Prince ride by on his horse.
One noticed nothing militaristic in his bearing. And so as the seconds passed and the clopping of his horse rang loudly in our ears like two giant pairs of wooden sandals, the image of his father, the Emperor, on his magnificent white horse, finally began to recede into another era. He dipped his head at people as he slowly passed, each dip a bow in miniature. In return, they bowed deeply to him, the weight of history on their backs. I bowed deeply, and then he was passed.
That's John Burnham Schwartz. His new novel, based on the life of a real empress of Japan, tells the story of a young girl who grows up to marry a prince whom she grows to love, has a son she adores, becomes empress, and then, in her later years, an unseen but powerful force for a kind of insurrection. Mr. Schwartz's new book is The Commoner. John Burnham Schwartz joins us in our studio. So nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Haruko's father is opposed at first when the entreaty comes from the palace. And not just, I must say this, speaking as a father, the reflexive, defensive, I don't care if he is a prince, he's not good for you,
yes.
Kind of. But her father seems to have some sense that this could be a lonely existence.
I think he has a sense both of what that might bring and a sense as well that his daughter, to him, seems a quite unusual person, rather extraordinary, with intelligence and interests far beyond that of a sort of typical Japanese young woman of the time. And he also, of course, loves her deeply. They're very close. And their relationship, though it may not cover a great many pages in the book, is fundamental to the book in the sense that it evokes the world that she has given up when she crosses over. So yes, he does make an attempt to sort of push back this initial interest on the part of the crown prince. But over time, that interest is really too strong in some sense to be denied. And the fact is that she does love him. This is not necessarily the case 30 years later with her son and his fiancée.
When Haruko becomes an empress, Haruko ceases to become a daughter, ceases almost at one point to become a mother, although she's still a very devoted mother. That's sort of some of those duties are taken from her. And she's told, no, you're the empress. You have more important things to do. On the one hand, it's hard to feel sorry for someone who becomes the empress, but inevitably you're led to.
Yes. I would say that the difference that I've found between, let's say, Princess Di, who is the, I guess, the obvious comparison. Princess Di, at her best, evoked in us a deep level of recognition for her human qualities, what it was in her that reminded us of how she was like us, and I use the us quite liberally. For the Japanese imperial family, their entire raison d'etre is a symbolic function. And the weight of history has been used and all of the strictures and limitations, the fact that they're almost never allowed to speak their own words, perform their own actions, in any way individually express themselves as human beings. The weight of all of this falls on them and is in some degree meant to flatten them, because a three-dimensional person can't be a symbol, a pure symbol. And these people are meant to be pure symbols. And so when the Japanese look at the empress and the crown princess and the other members of the imperial family, they are not encouraged or indeed prone to recognizing in them their own qualities and saying, oh, they're just like us. And so these people are, in fact, removed that much more from the actual atmosphere of real life.
At one point, Haruko says to her husband, the emperor, who she truly does seem to love, I need a friend. And he says,
we don't get to have friends. There's a quality of loneliness that is very poignant. It's something that I came to feel very strongly. I think that it's a terrible position to be in. I think the system, no matter what it may say, and the crown princess, when she came in, speaking her six languages and growing up all over the world, this young woman, it was said that she might transform the family. No such thing has happened. The family will not be transformed. And I think the more you know about the situation of these women in this world, you can't help, at a human level, want to know what it might be like to be human and alive in there, sort of trapped inside, while your holograph, as it were, is being beamed to the surface. And your holograph is speaking words that are not yours and performing actions that are not yours. And these are words and actions that have been spoken and performed for more than 1,000 years. And they have nothing to do with you.
What prevents Haruko from just one day walking across the moat and maybe not all at once, but trying to pick up the semblance of some ordinary life?
Well, a number of things. And this question is asked about the current crown princess as well, who, ever since she gave birth to her one child, a daughter, in 2001, Princess Aiko, has suffered a series of breakdowns and has hardly been seen in public for almost 4 years. If she does leave, she probably never sees her child again. They won't let these children go.
Because the child, in a sense, belongs to the nation.
It does. And there's no way, really, that she could go back into society. Whatever people say, the sympathy that younger people definitely have for her and the older generation has for the empress, who's in her 70s, nonetheless, if they were to do this, the sense of shirking their duty would be so shameful in that country that I think their lives would be impossible. Mm. When I did begin to imagine an ending for this book, one of the reasons I also wanted to write this book, in a sense, was that as a novelist, I'm looking for an ending to any book that has an organic quality to it. It's not an ending that I thought about 4 years ago and thought, oh, how perfect. It's an ending that actually comes out of the characters themselves and the lives that they have been living in this book and what they have done and how they have thought. The problem, the more I learned about the actual situation of these people and the imperial family, the more completely unacceptable it seemed to me, both in a human and a narrative sense, because the system is...
You mean just leaving?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, because actually the way it is now, with both of them sort of broken down and never leaving, because it denies the human at every turn. And by denying the human, it disallows that organic narrative quality that we're looking for in fiction as well as in life. And so I thought, you know, it's time to write my own ending. And then I struggled with that, but finally you find one that somehow seems to fit.
I mean, without giving anything away, it's an ending that would make you smile.
I thought it through as far as I could in a very logistical way.
Yeah.
It goes back to one of the things also that made me want to write this book, and that had to do always with the idea of the relationship between these two women.
Haruko and then Keiko,
yes,
the young
Keiko,
woman.
Yes, who's the crown princess.
Keiko is a young woman who comes into her life, also a commoner, speaks six languages, is, I guess, in the diplomatic service,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
Expected to become the first female head of the foreign ministry, which is just astounding in terms of a woman achieving that position in Japan.
And then Haruko's son, who at that point is the crown prince, asks her to marry him.
Yes, and he falls in love with her, and she rejects him three times. One can only imagine what that must take. The pressure in such an insular and homogeneous country in which duty plays such a large role.
Yeah.
And her father being a very prominent diplomat who has his own career to look after.
Well, Also, the reader is thinking, what would be so terrible about marrying
yes,
the prince?
Yeah. The thing is, she, at some level, she knew. But she also, you can't know. This goes back to the Empress.
Yeah.
She said no at first. She had some idea. Eventually, she chooses. But the problem is that it's not a choice, really. It's fixed. You cross the moat, you get in there, and you find that you're walking along and suddenly you fall down a well that's about 5,000 feet deep. Down at the bottom of the well is this civilization, if you can call it that, that's been going on forever. And they tell you what you will speak from now on, what words, and they tell you what you will do from now on. But then 30 years later, your son falls in love with this woman who at some level reminds you of you as you were then. And it's understandably you might want her to come down and join you. But the terrible irony is that she's the only one in the world who truly knows what that means, to bring her down, to say, come down here with me. And maybe she does, in fact, as the rumor had it, meet with her privately and offer to protect her, which is something she cannot follow through on. And at a certain point, you have to imagine that the older woman really asks herself, well, how long can we allow this to go on?
John Burnham Schwartz's new novel is The Commoner. You can hear the author talk more about the Imperial Japanese family and read an excerpt from his book at npr.org/books.
Dan Ariely conducts great experiments. They involve mock auctions, trick-or-treating on Halloween, selling chocolate to college students on campus. Ariely is on the faculty at MIT. He's on leave teaching at Duke. He is a behavioral economist. Dan Ariely tries to answer the question, how do we make economic decisions? And here's his conclusion. We don't do it the way economists typically say we do. We are predictably irrational. That's the title of his book. Here's one of his concerns. How do we come to attach a value, a price that we're willing to pay, for a piece of candy?
Think about a piece of chocolate. It's melting in your mouth. You feel it. You smell it. You taste it. There's a little nut inside. In standard economic lingo, you should have a reservation price. You should have the maximum willingness to pay for this particular experience. But if you reflect on it and you say, how do I actually do it? How do I take this experience and translate it into money? You would realize that it's in fact a very hard exercise, and it's completely unclear how we map pleasure onto money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking of this piece of chocolate. If it's inside the minibar of a hotel room in a multi-star hotel for the fancy European label, I might be willing to pay a lot more than something at the office that's standing on a counter.
And the experience will not be very different itself. It's just that our willingness to pay, it turns out, is not just a function of the utility, of the pleasure that we expect to get from it. It's also influenced by all kinds of irrelevant factors that change our psychology, but not our economic reasoning.
Now, I'd like you to relate the actual fieldwork, the experiments that you've done on, I guess, somewhat unwitting MIT students with the price of chocolate.
So we came to a big class of students, and we asked them all to give us their last two digits of their social security number. So in my case, it will be 79. And then we asked them to write that number next to each of the products. There were wine bottles, there were computer parts, there were books, there were chocolates. So I would write $79 next to each of those. And after that, we asked them to write whether they would pay that number. So whether they would pay, in my case, $79 for each of those products, and they wrote yes or no. And then we got to the crux of the experiment, in which we asked them to bid in an auction on each of those items, any price that they would. And everybody bidded. We found out who was the highest winner. They got up, they paid their price, and they got their product. But then what we did was to calculate the relationship between people's social security numbers and their willingness to pay in the auction. Now, this sounds like a very strange idea, aside from the fact that they have made a decision about their social security number. They said, would I pay $79 for this thing, yes or no? And the question was, would this initial decision penetrate their next decision? And the answer was very much so. And in fact, the correlation between their social security numbers and how much they were paying for the product ended up being at about 0.5.
That the lower the person's social security number, the last two digits, the lower the price they'd be willing to bid.
That's right. But it's not the fact that people with high social security are prone to pay a lot of money for everything in their lives. It's the fact that they contemplated that number. I mean, we could have made them contemplate all kinds of things. We could have made it contemplate the weather, their shoe size, whatever it was. But once they contemplated something, when they came to the next decision, the first contemplation lasted and influences their later decisions as well.
Because you've made me think about a number in my head, the last two digits of my social security number, and relate it to things, it remains a benchmark in my mind.
That's right. So in my case, I would think, yes, I said $79 was too much for this wine. How much is okay? Well, maybe 65. But I stayed too close to that number.
Now, you also have an experiment in which you illustrate the remarkable power of giving away things for free where the price is zero.
Yes. The interesting thing is that many times free things are good. But the question is, what happens when free actually has a downside? What happens that to get a free cone of ice cream, you have to stand 2 hours in line? Are people going to overvalue free and be willing to do too much for it and, in fact, end up paying too much? So we did a large set of experiments. Maybe the most cute one is one in which kids who came on Halloween to my house one day, and I first gave them all 3 Hershey Kisses. And I asked them to keep their hand open and to keep the 3 Hershey Kisses outside, not in the bag. And then I gave them another option. I said, here I have 2 Snickers bar, a small Snickers bar and a large Snickers bar. And I will give you one of those and only one of those, but here's the deal. If you want the small one, give me 1 Hershey Kiss. If you want the big one, give me 2 Hershey Kisses.
You just gave them the Hershey Kisses before this.
That's right. So I knew they had them. And now they had to decide, basically, was it worthwhile giving me an extra Hershey Kiss for the bigger one compared to the small one? And virtually everybody saw that this was a fantastic deal. You know, just chocolate per chocolate, they got 8 times their investment for getting the large Hershey Kiss. But here is the other thing that I gave to another set of kids. I discounted both Snickers bar by the same amounts. I said you could have the small one for free, or you could get the big one for 1 Hershey Kiss. Now, the relationship was the same. They should have still asked themselves, is it worthwhile to give an extra Hershey Kiss to get the big one? And in fact, it was still a tremendous deal. But in this case, the kids went largely for the free one, basically giving up a better deal, a fantastic deal, just because of the allure of free. And by the way, this is not just with kids. We replicated experiments with Amazon gift certificates and products and chocolates with MIT students and adults. And everybody has the same issue, that free is such a hot button that many times it tempts us so much that we end up paying a high price or give up something better just for the allure of free.
By the way, did you happen to catch any of the conversations between the trick-or-treating kids and their parents as they left your front door on that Halloween?
So many of the parents were very concerned.
I'm not surprised, yes.
You know, some of them would let the kid walk alone so the kids feel a little bit independent. But as I started the offer, they would get closer and closer, checking out that I'm not doing anything fishy with their kids. The kids actually took it very well. They're used to trading chocolates at Halloween and so on. But the parents were curious, and many of them remained and asked me questions about it.
Well, just one last question before I let you go, which is, if indeed we are as irrational as you would have us, does behavioral economics pretty well make a mess of regular economics and say that can't be describing human behavior since it's not the way we behave?
That's right. So behavioral economics flies in the face of standard economics in two ways. One is we say your model of human being is wrong. And the second and more important thing is saying, as a consequence of this, your prescription for policy is also wrong. And that's actually the most important part of this. If you understand the places where people are irrational and make mistakes, you need to think differently about policies for healthcare, for saving, for driving, for smoking, for anything you want that is different from the one that standard economic prescribes.
Well, Dan Ariely, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Ariely's book is called Predictably Irrational. In the introduction, he writes about the time in his life when he became intrigued by these questions, 3 years as a patient in an Israeli burn unit. You can hear that story at our website, npr.org.
Our series, You Must Read This, gives authors a chance to talk about the books they love. Today, we hear from writer Sloane Crosley. She's also a publicist at Vintage Books. She tells us about a story that features a nasty child heroine, a bleak secret, and lots of flowers.
Whatever the opposite of seasonal affective disorder is, I have it. I love the winter, especially in Manhattan, where the funneled winds dare you to leave your house in the morning. I am dubious of spring's high expectations for renewal, those months when it's commonly considered an infraction to be inside ever. Which is perhaps the reason I have always found solace in Frances Burnett's The Secret Garden. The Secret Garden is the story of Mary Lennox, a bitter and selfish little girl who hates the world and everyone in it. After she is orphaned by a cholera epidemic in India, she is sent to live with an estranged uncle on his sprawling, creepy English country estate. When she first arrives, she is pale and thin and sporting a personality that would smell like sour milk if it could. She detests the outdoors. With a little help from her maid and a boy named Dickon, Mary gradually develops the pleasant demeanor of a normal girl. So, paradoxically, India made Mary pale, hostile, and unaccustomed to strange foods, whereas England makes her healthy, rose-cheeked, and full of zen. As the book's title unsubtly suggests, there is also a garden involved, complete with hidden door and buried key. In many obvious ways, there is no finer novel, young adult or otherwise, to reread while those first fingers of green are poking up through the ground. There is no single book that can more readily transport you into spring as you sit underneath a tree and listen to some bird whose name you don't remember whistle a tune that you do. But the real reason to love this book is because, not unlike the garden hidden in plain sight around which it centers, the novel itself has its own dark secret. And that is the following. It is not a nice book, despite its goody-goody reputation. The illustrations should have been rendered by Edward Gorey. The Secret Garden is about neglect of plants and of people. Back in India, Mary's mother was a socialite who never wanted her. After the cholera epidemic dissipates, it takes fully 5 days before Mary is found alone in the dark of her bungalow. Her only company had been a snake. Mary is taken to England, where everyone she meets repeatedly insults her to her face. Her only friend is a robin, and her only solace is found in being alone. One night, Mary hears crying in a distant corridor of the mansion and goes to investigate. Curled up among the dusty tapestries is Colin, her uncle's sickly son. It takes Mary, little strumpet that she is, about a page and a half to spill the seeds about the Secret Garden. The Secret Garden is half charm, half wickedness, half summer and half winter. At one point, Mary asks her maid why the garden was locked in the first place. She gradually learns its painful history, But in that innocent question lies the lasting magic of the secret garden. It is always the flowers that one notices first before inspecting the dirt below.
Sloane Crosley is the author of the forthcoming book of essays, I Was Told There'd Be Cake. You can find an excerpt from The Secret Garden and more You Must Read This recommendations at npr.org/books. This is NPR, National Public Radio.